We're in Acts 21. If you don't have a new outline, they're back in the back. There was one Acts 20 that I found in my office, so I put that back there as well in case you did not get Acts 20. There was one of those. As you all know, I like to be redundant and go back and remember things and bring things back, and it helps us to learn and scaffold that understanding. And so I want to spend, this is a less exciting chapter than some of the previous chapters in the sense of the density of content and all the connections to be made. So since we have a little bit of extra time, I want to just go back and give a little bit of summaries of where we've been and kind of break down, generally speaking, this book into five parts. And we're in the last part. We're starting tonight the very last of the five parts of the book of Acts. And so all of these are loosely speaking ways I'm dividing it. That necessarily doesn't mean anything, but just how it helps me to understand what's going on. Point out a couple things that might be helpful to take note of. So Acts 1 through 12, who are we following in Acts 1 through 12? Specifically Peter. The apostles are obviously in the first 7-8 chapters, and then the next four, you know, Peter's ministry is kind of at the forefront there, right? And so after that, we got Acts 13 and 14. In Acts 13, Paul and Barnabas are ordained, evidently, and they go on their first missionary journey in 13 and 14. Now, if you look on our map, you'll remember, and this is, you can just look at the map that you've got in front of you. They start in Antioch on the right side in Syria. That's going to be their home base this whole time through the whole book of Acts. It seems like that's likely where Paul's a member at, Barnabas is a member at, Silas likely a member at. And they're going on these long journeys, and they always come back to Antioch, their home church. They always give a report of what's going on to tell of the news that's going on there. And so Antioch, to the far right side of your page, Syria, there's Antioch there. That's always the starting place. It started in 13:14. But as far as they got was Galatia. So they go from Antioch. If you remember, they travel down to the island of Cyprus. They travel through there, two different places at least, perhaps more. Then they go up into Galatia. They start in Antioch and Pisidia. So that's at the very middle of the map in the green. They go down to Iconium, Lystra, into Derbe. Paul gets beat in Derbe. And then he goes back to Lystra, Iconium, Antioch, and Pisidia, and then finally back to Antioch. Right? So a small loop our first time around, but even in that one trip, he's traveled to those places twice. Once to see them converted on an evangelistic mission, and the second time on a teaching mission. And after he gets back, so that's in 13:14, and then in 15 we have this really big happening, the Jerusalem Council. Basically, this is the first time, so obviously Acts 10, he goes to the household of Cornelius, which was a Gentile. That could have been looked at as an anomaly. Going to the Gentile household, bunch of people getting converted, that's just an anomaly. His mission trip was showing this is not an anomaly. This is now going to be a norm that Jewish believers are going to evangelize into Gentile communities to try to form these multi-ethnic groups that we know today as a church. He shows in that first missionary journey that was not an outlier. This is a norm now. And so the Jerusalem church kind of calls him to the carpet about it. What are you doing? And at the primary point of it is Acts, I think, 15 and 5, where they say, what do we tell these new Gentile believers about the law of Moses and circumcision? Should we have them circumcised, and do they need to believe and practice the law of Moses? And they come to a conclusion, and if you remember, and tonight in Acts 21, we'll have a reference back to the letter that they wrote. They write a letter to all those Gentile communities and all those Jews saying, hey, this is what you need to do. And it basically focuses on morality. I mean, don't sacrifice or don't eat food sacrificed to idols. Don't whatever. All these different things about morality. So I would say Acts 13, 14, and 15. You got the first missionary journey as well as that Jerusalem Council kind of has phase two in the book of Acts. Okay. beginning technically in Acts 15, 36 through 41, is the second missionary journey. But we'll just for ease sake say Acts 16. Okay? Now, Paul is going to exchange traveling companions. Why is he exchanging traveling companions again? It was Barnabas. But at the end of Acts 15, he and Barnabas are about to go, but they don't anymore. Why? They have a disagreement over John Mark. Now, it already told us in the book of Acts, perhaps, and we have to infer a little bit, why that was the case. What did John Mark do earlier in Acts that might have caused Paul's hesitance? Correct. He left the missionary journey. So you remember they went to Cyprus together and then they got to Pamphylia, which is right there in the middle with the yellow, Pamphylia. And that's where he departs. He does not travel through Galatia. Right? So this next time around, Paul has a sharp enough disagreement to say, no, we don't want them. We don't want him to come. Barnabas can't agree. Remember, Barnabas and John Mark are first cousins, right? So I'm not saying that was the cause of it, but we'll just say that's the potential reason why Barnabas wanted to bring him. What happens is Paul chooses Silas, and they follow, and if you look at your map, they follow basically the beginning of that first route. So they go through Cilicia into Galatia, restrengthening the churches. So that's now the third time, second journey, but the third time they've made it through Galatia. But Barnabas and John Mark go to Cyprus, which was the prior place that John Mark had traveled with Barnabas and Paul on the first journey. So they go south into the sea, and that's where they're doing their missionary work. Now, this is the point when Paul gets to Antioch in Pisidia, where he's told, don't go to Asia, don't go to Bithynia, which would seem like the natural places to go after you've been to Galatia. He's forbidden by the Holy Spirit to do that. He travels up to Troas, which is in the northwest corner of Asia, and that's where he has the Macedonian call. This man appears to him in Acts 16 saying, come help us. So that kind of sets him going into what continues that journey. Although this reflects the third journey, it follows the path of the second to some extent. He goes up to Philippi. He goes to Thessalonica, to Berea. He goes down to Corinth. So we make that whole journey down there into Macedonia where he's witnessing to those people. That's the second journey. So that's from 16 through chapter 18, verse 22 is Paul's second journey. So I would say that's the third stage of our book of Acts. The fourth stage is going to be the third journey, right, which has been Acts 18 to where we are presently. We're finishing up the third journey just now. Okay, so in this case, you can see the third journey here. He goes to Ephesus multiple times in this journey. Now, in all these places, we've not, just because we're summarizing, denoted how long he stayed in these places. Some of these places, he stayed up to 3 years, right? Ephesus, 3 years, he said in the last chapter. Corinth, he was there 18 months. So these aren't just 1 week or 2 week mission trips. And so now we're at the place where we're to the fifth and final leg of the book of Acts and what we're following. He has been in this, on this third journey, he's trying to get back to Jerusalem. Now, up to this point, his work has really turned the world upside down. Right? It's going to tell us in chapter 21 that there are thousands of believers, Jewish believers in Jerusalem, that when they hear that he is present in Jerusalem, it's going to cause a problem. And they're believers, but it's going to cause a problem because of what has been supposed that he's been teaching out in the Gentile mission works. And so the elders are going to say, you need to have some explaining. You need to be prepared to be received of these people. What are we going to do so that you're received of these Jewish believers? So the only reason I'm saying this detail now is to reveal the fact that at this present time, Paul is known, what he's doing is known everywhere. It's not just some itinerant preacher like he started out probably on the first journey. Now his works are well known. We've had a number of times as we've gone through Acts where it said his preaching was well known all throughout Asia. Right? Remember when he went to the school of Tyrannus and it said that about him. The word is spread all through Asia. Well, look how big Asia is. So we know this following is really big. And most likely, as is common, he's looked at the leader of the following. Now, he's not, in many ways. God is. But from the secular world, he's looked at as he's the ringleader. And that's even what Nero is going to think in due time, presumably. So we come into this. He's trying to get back to Jerusalem. If you remember where we left off in Acts 20, was he was saying goodbye to the Jewish elders, or excuse me, the Ephesian elders. He was saying goodbye to the Ephesian elders. So technically right now, if you look in the middle of Asia, you can see where Ephesus is at. He is on his way back to Jerusalem from that middle place in Ephesus. And so today, he's going to make his way all the way to Jerusalem and stop at these places along the way. So again, five general phases of the book of Acts to put it to memory. And we're in our last one that we're getting to here. This last one is him going from Jerusalem to Rome. So he's about to get arrested today. And from here, he's going to try to be making it to Rome. It's going to take a long time to do that. And he's not going to finish that in the book of Acts. But just wanted to give you guys a background. So is there anything you feel like, big picture-wise, summarizing this that I've missed? Or something you want to add to that? Anything? All right, so Paul's in Ephesus to begin, but he's finishing the third missionary journey. So it says this in verse 1 at the very top of your page. And it came to pass that after we were gotten from them and had launched, we came with a straight course unto Coos. So let's look at where we're at here. From Ephesus, do you all see? It's right in the middle of the page. It's really small. It says Coos right there. Some of you got to get your bifocals on if you're going to see it. All right, it's real small. And the day falling unto Rhodes. So Rhodes is the little island there. You can see that a little plainer. And from thence unto Patara. Is that right? How you pronounce that? It's over there in Lycia. You can kind of see that in the brownish color. Let's see here. And finding a ship sailing over unto Phoenicia. I'm trying to find where that's at. I may not have it here. May not be noted. I don't see it here. We went aboard and set forth. Now when we had discovered Cyprus, we left it on the left hand and sailed into Syria. Now, the only thing I'll point out about how this is written is notice how detailed Luke is. He even tells you the route he's taken. Right? Luke was a physician. Even in the Gospel of Luke, he's very detailed. How many people are there? He's a very detailed writer. And this is just another example of it. He's saying, we set sail and we went past Cyprus and it was on our left-hand side, just in case you were wondering, right? So we can kind of see some of his writing style there. And sailed into Syria. So they made it to the land. And landed at Tyre. Now, Tyre and Sidon should sound familiar to us because those were places that Jesus went and rebuked for their unbelief. And he basically said, it's going to be rougher for you in the judgment than it would be even for the Ninevites or Sodom and Gomorrah. Okay, I can't remember which one. But one of those two, he said, it's going to be rougher for you because you've rejected, obviously, a prophet that's greater than what Jonah or Lot was. And so it says, for there the ship was unlaid her burden. So it seems like it was probably a cargo ship, and they were just catching a ride on that cargo ship. Verse 4, and finding disciples, we tarried there 7 days. So eventually, after Jesus' ministry, evidently there were some people that believed in Tyre and Sidon. Or, of course, it could have been during the time of Jesus, but it just doesn't give us those details in the Gospels. So they find disciples there. And this is what we referenced last week. So remember last week, we went to chapter 19, and we said that Paul felt purposed in the Spirit to go somewhere. In chapter 20, some people were evidently led of the Spirit to stop him. And now in 21, these people who said to Paul through the Spirit, don't go to Jerusalem. So we have that strange duality of the Lord leading people to warn him, and the Lord evidently leading Paul to still go. So that was that verse that we talked about last week and tried to make some comparisons there. That he should not go up to Jerusalem. And when we accomplished those days, we departed and went our way. And they all brought us on our way with wives and children till we were out of the city. And we kneeled down on the shore and prayed. So this is now the second time this has happened. It happened in Ephesus, where the elders were saying goodbye. They bowed down on the shore weeping, saying goodbye to him. And now this is another occurrence. Verse 6. Now, I think what this is indicating is that they think he's going to die when he goes to Jerusalem. That's why they're so sad. They keep warning him, don't go, don't go. Bad things await you. And now both the Ephesian elders, he tells them, God has showed me I'm never going to see you again. Well, what would you assume if you're going to the city where Jesus died, where you're well known throughout the whole area, and that the most ardent followers of Judaism, and violent ones for that matter, are in Jerusalem, and he's going there? You're probably going to assume he's going to die there. So it seems to me, what I infer from this is they're weeping and they're sad. They think he's going to die. It says in verse 6, and when we had taken our leave one of another, we took ship and they returned home again. And we had finished our course from Tyre, we came to Ptolemais and saluted the brethren and abode with them one day. So you'll notice there's believers in every city. They stop there, they see him for just a moment. And the next day, we that were of Paul's company departed and came unto Caesarea, and we entered into the house of Philip the evangelist, which was one of the seven, and abode with him. So we'll stop there for a moment. One of the seven, what? One of the seven. Deacons, right? We go back to Acts 6. They set aside seven. And this is explicitly telling us, this is Philip, one of the seven. Now, I've heard people at times say that Philip the evangelist and Philip the deacon were two different people. That seems to overturn that. It explicitly says this was one of the seven. Now, I find it neat that where Philip was living, Caesarea. Why is that significant? Well, because in Acts 8, Philip, we see that the Samaritans begin to believe. Right? Samaritans, Caesarea is a city of Samaria. So Philip has now settled there, and he is trying to witness to these people there in Caesarea, in one of those cities. And so it calls him Philip the evangelist, which was one of the seven and abode with him. And the same man had four daughters, virgins or unmarried, which did prophesy. And as we tarried there many days, there came down from Judea a certain prophet named Agabus. And when he was come unto us, he took Paul's girdle and bound his own hands and feet and said, thus saith the Holy Ghost, so shall the Jews at Jerusalem bind the man that owneth this girdle and shall deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles. I want to stop there for a moment and just get your feedback. And I don't have an opinion on this. I'm just curious what you think. So right now we have the introduction of four prophetesses. Right? So to ask this plainly, are any of you ladies prophetesses? All right. Peggy, you're laughing. Are you holding out on us? What does that mean? Like, I don't have much of an opinion on it. I don't know. I mean, I can do the Google search, right? But as for being able to tell post, or rather church age, what that explicitly means, I don't know. And then we have it not really telling us of their activities. But then someone comes down named Agabus, and he does make a prophecy that ends up being true. Now remember, before we had a prophecy about Jerusalem going through a drought, and so money was sent to alleviate the church at Jerusalem. That all took place. Here this is taking place, where Agabus comes forward. You can just imagine, he ties his hands and his feet with his belt-like garment or item, and he says, whoever owns this, that's what the Jews are going to do to you in Jerusalem. And that's what the Holy Ghost says. And will deliver you into the hands of the Gentiles. Now that can be understood as the Romans, which by the end of this chapter is going to happen. Anybody have any thoughts about what that means or the significance of that?
Paul knew what he was about ready to head into with foreknowledge. Mm-hmm. And he still went.
Okay, so it does reveal to us certainly a courage about Paul. There's no doubt what he's going to face when he gets there. It's now beyond speculation. It's to prophecy. Right? So there would seem to be a clearer affirmation what's going to happen. Do you all take from this also that Agabus did not know whose girdle that was? That's how I read it. He grabs this girdle. He's moved by the Holy Spirit to grab this thing, to make that action, and to make this statement. That's how I interpret it. I don't, the way it's written, just because he says, bind the man that owneth this girdle. That seems to imply he didn't know at the time whose that was, and it became apparent. So, again, we got Philip. Now, the other thing we can say is Philip had obviously followed the Lord in previous chapters in Acts chapter 8. And it evidently had an effect on his daughters. It seems to say that they were of the religious sort in a positive way. And so we see that it may have had an effect on his daughters as he was following the Lord. Now the reaction to this. Notice in verse 12 it says, when we. So Luke is lumping himself into this response. And when we heard these things, both we and they of that place. Now remember, Luke is with seven traveling companions. So it seems like he's saying is there were eight of us. Remember, we read the list last week from Thessalonica, somewhere from all these places, Berea. Remember Trophimus and Sopater and all these random names that we don't really remember. They're all together. All eight of them, it seems like, begin to say, Paul, don't go. Please don't go. Again, this is my imagination, so don't read this into the text. It's almost like this has been building up in them. Everywhere they're going, people are grieving and saying, Paul, don't go. Don't go. And then this is finally the time where it spills over in them. They're as close to Jerusalem as they're going to get. So the next stop is Jerusalem. And so now his eight traveling companions are saying, please don't go. Along with the people that are there who just heard this prophecy from Agabus saying, you're going to be imprisoned. And again, I think any natural person would assume going to be put to death. Because that's exactly what happened to Jesus. The Jews apprehended him. They handed him over to the Gentiles and he died. So it would be, I think, a natural assumption for that to be the case. And so, again, just the intrigue of how Luke writes this, he wants you to know his traveling companions are trying to intervene. He makes a distinction between the traveling companions and those at that location to show us all these people are begging him not to go. And they of that place besought him not to go up to Jerusalem. Then Paul answered, what mean ye to weep and to break mine heart? So, essentially, stop it. You're breaking my heart by asking, by telling me not to go. And he responds, for I am ready not to be bound only, but also to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus. And when he would not be persuaded, we ceased, saying, the will of the Lord be done. Now, there's just a part of that last couple verses that just I really appreciate reading. There's just a love, and yet it's spiritual here. So you can see they deeply love this man. And it's real. And they're probably so mindful. And you would, the natural mind would say, Paul, look at all you've done. You're in decent health. Look at how much more you could do. And you would think their temptation was, let's convince him not to waste his life. Right? I mean, a lot of us would think that. And it would be tempting if there was, you know, a young family that was feeling burdened to go somewhere dangerous, or a young man who's a minister and he's feeling burdened to go somewhere dangerous, where we would say, don't do it. Because from our vantage point, it just doesn't seem like the natural flow of where things should go. Right? Well, you've got so much potential, and think of how much good you could do in other places or doing other things. But it's vital to remember, we don't see the way God sees. Right? Paul being imprisoned was going to spread the gospel through the whole imperial guard and all the Roman Empire even further. And we find that in the prison letters. And so God had a purpose in allowing him to be captured. Think of all what we're going to experience from this point forward. He's going to be in bond or enslaved. You know, he's going to be a captive. He's going to travel before Felix and all the people in front of Felix. He's going to get handed over to Agrippa and all the people that are there that he's able to witness to. He's going to go, if you remember when he gets to the island, what was it? Was it Cyprus that he gets to, and he gets bitten by a snake? One of those islands. He gets bitten by a snake. He's witnessing to all of those people that had not been witnessed to before. So God takes him a different route. But we have to appreciate the love that is moving these people. Because what they do is basically say this: we love you. Please don't do this. And they're begging him. But when his response is, the Lord has bound me to go, I have to go, and I'm prepared not only to be bound in Jerusalem, but to die, they stop. And they say, let the Lord's will be done. And to me, this is a wonderful snapshot example of how we ought to be. It perfectly blends genuine love, deep, affectionate love. Don't do it if you don't have to, because I love you. But the moment you say that necessity has been laid upon me, ultimately, if a person really loves you, or you really love a person, ultimately you want them to do the will of the Lord, even if it comes at your loss. And that's what they demonstrate here. I love you, but the Lord's will be done. And I imagine, now this same phrase, thy will be done, obviously Jesus uttered in the garden. And it's leading to, again, an unpleasantness. And I think at times we've got to remember, sometimes that's the words of, those are the last, the resignation words. I don't want to interfere with the Lord's plan. And I'm having a hard time condoning, because of love, the Lord's will be done. I just want the Lord's will done. Now, I said on my outline, I just wrote this for myself, is I think sometimes we're idealistic. We can be idealistic in thinking, well, if you're following the Lord and I'm following the Lord, we'll always come to the same conclusion. And sometimes I think that's just a little idealistic. We should. But the reality is, as fallen creatures, sometimes we misperceive, one of us or both of us can misperceive the will of the Lord. And it's necessary, it can be a spiritual elitism to think of ourselves that I for sure know the will of God, you can't tell me anything. That can be a spiritual elitism. I'm not saying it necessarily is, but it can be. And I think what I love here is they, evidently, this is how it seems to me, and you can disagree with this, it seems like these people telling him not to go really believe they're warning him from the Holy Spirit. And as Brother Gerald brought up last week, they may have been. And Paul really believes the Holy Spirit is leading him to Jerusalem. And evidently he was. And yet in the end, when there couldn't come a consensus, they all stepped back and said, the Lord's will be done. That's what we want. And I think sometimes, rather than trying to press our case further into this spiritual idealism that we'll all just agree and everybody will get the same answer, I hope that happens. But sometimes I think this shows it won't. And what we have to do is just say, all of us evidently want the Lord's will to be done, and I'm going to trust that God will arrange it to where His will is done. And I may not comprehend it, and it may not fit what I suspected or what they suspected, but to taking hands off and putting it in the hands of God. And this to me is an example of almost a spiritual disagreement that is resolved the way it ought to be. And it's a lesson to us that can be the case. Somebody have a comment or a thought you want to offer about anything we talked about, whether it be the prophets, prophetesses, or this last account here. All right, if you look at the bottom of page 2, we'll continue our reading here. It says in verse 15, and after those days, we took up our carriages and went up to Jerusalem. So again, note, just prior, they were taking ships, even along the coastline from Tyre. Now Luke is detailed enough to say, we took carriages, and so now we know that they're traveling by land. And went up to Jerusalem. There went with us also certain of the disciples of Caesarea, so from a Samaritan area, and brought with them one, I'm going to say Mason, silent N, right? Is that right? Anybody? Mason, silent M, or Asen, silent MN, I don't know, of Cyprus, an old disciple with whom we should lodge. So this man seemed to be of the island of Cyprus, but he evidently had a home in Jerusalem, and he was an old disciple, and he was going to bring them, let them stay with him. And we were come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. And the day following, Paul went in with us unto James, and all the elders were present. And we had saluted them, he declared particularly what things God had wrought among the Gentiles by his ministry. So he gave this extensive mission report to these people, James and all the elders at least. And again, I just want to point out, the same thing happened in Acts chapter 11. If you remember in Acts chapter 10, the day of Cornelius, things happens. We go to Acts 11. Peter comes, he reports to the Jerusalem elders and all the people, this is what God did among the Gentiles, and it says almost the exact same phrase, that they rejoiced and they glorified God. So we can see the maturity in these men, which is no understatement. It was a big point of maturity even still that Jews are receiving Gentiles. It's a big deal. So when Paul comes and basically says, hey, for the last 5 years, I've traveled here, and I've traveled there, and this is what happened here, and he's going through detail after detail, saying, I established churches here, and I did it there, and it's all among these Gentile places. And they hear all these things, and they glorify God. It's just showing that wall of partition in Ephesians chapter 2, that it separated the Jews and the Gentiles, are broken down. And that the church in Jerusalem is beginning to accept this new conception of the people of God. It is not based upon ethnicity. It is based upon being born from above, being a child of God, regardless of our ethnicity. And this is another example of showing that what ought to be the most mature church, there in Jerusalem, where Jesus ministered, where the apostles were, where the day of Pentecost takes place, where all these events, they're really receiving these things, right? And so it says, they glorified God and said unto him, and this is where I'm not sure what to make of this next portion. So I would encourage you to pay attention to this next part and see what you think about this. Thou seest, brother, how many thousands of Jews there are which believe, and they are all zealous of the law. And they are informed of thee, that thou teachest all the Jews which are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise their children, neither to walk after the customs. So let's break this down into what is trying to be said. Does everyone agree that verse 20 is saying there are thousands of Jews in Jerusalem which are saved? Is that how you interpret which believe? Thou seest, brother, how many thousands of Jews there are which believe. Seems to be what he's saying. And they are all zealous of the law. So the way I understand that is it's saying they got saved. They're not sure how to blend Judaism with this. This harkens back to the letter in Acts 15. That was the same problem that was having then. How do we blend the old covenant with the new covenant? What do we do about this? Okay? Again, I'm giving you my interpretation. I want you to poke holes in it if you can. It says, and they are informed of thee, so they know about you, and basically what you're doing is what they know about. That thou teachest all the Jews which are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses. So, every place we've gone, and Meg, I'm going to hit you cold. Do you know how many times so far he's preached in the synagogues? 8? 9? Okay, so at least 9 times... it specifically says that he goes to the synagogue and he's preaching in these cities, right? Now, the reason why this is notable is because what it's saying here, he'd go to these cities, he'd start in the Jewish synagogue. Sometimes they'd reject him And he says, okay, I'm going to go preach to the Gentiles now. We found at Corinth, remember the two synagogue leaders were both converted. What was it? Silvanus and Gaius? I can't remember who it was. Two people. Two people were converted. So we know the Jews were converted. And then he'd go to the Gentiles and some of them would get converted. And then they'd start a church. Well, naturally, one of the questions that's going to arise is, do these Gentiles have to circumcise and keep the law of Moses? And now some of these Jews are having children, and if the Gentiles don't have to circumcise their kids, do we need to circumcise our kids? And so, when you're bringing in new people from new cultures, we got to sort through both first what is lawful, and second what is expedient. I think that's a question very often when people are trying to read the scriptures, they mistaken. Oftentimes what people are looking for is right and wrong. And when they think they find what is right, they just cling to it and say, we got to do this, and if you don't, you're wrong. And I think what we're going to learn in this example is that God is, and Paul here is not, and these elders are not so concerned with the legality as with the expedience. Meaning, in this context, even though we're allowed to do this, will our action divide us and cause trouble to our gathering? Is it expedient to do? Is it a wise and prudent thing to do this, even if God is okay with us doing this? And so, it seems as though that's kind of at the core of this question that they're asking, is these men have heard. Now, likely, I would have a hard time believing that Paul, so if you think of it like this, if you think of Jews that were in Corinth or Thessalonica or Berea or any of these places up in Achaia and Macedonia, and they go back to Jerusalem at some point after Paul had been to their city, and they come back, and they're trying to explain to their family or these people that they're with in Jerusalem what Paul taught there. Do you think they got the explanation 100% accurate when they would talk to their family? Probably not. Right? Just like all of us, it's likely that they're coming back with an incomplete understanding. And to me, we can sort of infer this when it says this in verse 21. And they are informed of thee that thou teachest all the Jews which are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses. Now, I just don't think Paul was going to Corinthian synagogue and saying, you all need to stop obeying the law of Moses. I don't think he was doing that at all. Now, do I think that he was saying he was changing their understanding of the place of the Mosaic law? Absolutely, he was doing that. But I just have a hard time assuming that he actually said this strict of a statement here. Forsake the law of Moses. So it seems to me what these elders are saying is there's hearsay. And here's the summarized hearsay. Forsake the law of Moses and don't circumcise your children and don't walk after our customs. And so they're concerned for Paul, even among the Jewish believers. Will Paul be heard if his reputation is one that is tearing down the Judaistic way? And so they take a unique approach here, and I don't know what to make of it. And this is where I'd like your thoughts. It says, what is it therefore? So what do we do? That's how I read that. The multitude must needs come together, for they will hear that thou art come. Do therefore this that we say to thee. So here is the elders' prescription as to how Paul can be received by these Jewish believers in Jerusalem. Now I'll just pause here and note this. Up to this point in Acts, has Paul spent hardly any time in Jerusalem? No. Antioch's been his home base. He's been to Jerusalem, I think, if I can remember right, once. That it explicitly says he traveled back to Jerusalem. He was there a short time, then he went right back up to Antioch. So the likelihood is these people don't know Paul. They know Peter, they know James, they know the apostles, they know those from the day of Pentecost, they know all that. But Paul is kind of a stranger to them. And so they're justifiably suspicious of Paul. They don't know him. He's saying some crazy stuff. And so it seems like the elders are saying, in order to gain their respect and to show them, you're not just saying tear down the whole Jewish customs and traditions, here's what we prescribe you do. Now, I want to pause there. I've already, developed a pretty rigid framework. Something you want to add to what I've said or disagree with? Propose something different. Does it seem like to you in verse 21 that they're trying to thwart the hearsay?
I mean, they're expressing what the mass Christian Jews think.
Mm-hmm.
They're just preparing him to be ready to answer and to make a symbol of keeping his purity. But I don't know why he did it. He didn't have to. But he did it anyway, just to make it not put up a barrier that doesn't need to be there.
Mm-hmm. Somebody else have a thought about what they're proposing to him, what these Jews must have thought, just this whole context going on here. Anybody have a thought? Now, what was it? In Acts, I think the only reason I remember it is because the same chapter verse. Acts 18:18. Remember it told us that he shaved his head. You guys remember that? Paul, I think it says in the King James, shorn his head because he was keeping a vow. So we know that he had been keeping a vow prior, that he cut his hair. And now here we are again. And they say this. This is what they're proposing that he do. We have four men which have a vow on them. Them take and purify thyself with them and be at charges with them. So evidently there's an offering associated with this vow that essentially what they're saying is you pay for their offering. At least that's how I understand it. That they may shave their heads and all may know that those things whereof they were informed concerning thee are nothing, but that thou thyself also walkest orderly and keepest the law. So again, I'm going to pose, this is going to be probably a statement, maybe, but I'm meaning it as a question. So I think what it's saying is either go with these people and do the same thing they're doing, or just go with them and pay for them to do it in order to show that you are in support of what they're doing, which is obviously a Jewish tradition. And that will let people know that you are walking orderly and that your reputation has been mistaken. You are not saying tear down the ways of Moses. That's what I take from that. But as you can tell, I don't feel very sure about it. Anybody have a thought?
It sounds like they were suggesting that he become a Nazarite along with them.
Mm-hmm.
And thereby show that he's not in favor of, knocking the law down.
And it's a good visual, too. There's thousands of them. So Paul's not going to be able to talk to all thousands of them. So they're going to know just on sight. And they're going to be able to tell friends that didn't see him, I don't understand what's going on because my cousin from Thessalonica said this, but I know Paul shaved his head. He was doing this vow. He was with these people. He went through the purification process. So there's this visual that's demonstrating a reality. And it seems like the elders are proposing him follow that just so people can know what's going on. But again, I haven't studied a lot of the vows of the Old Testament and how those things kind of, they may suggest more here that I'm just ignorant of.
The elders are just trying to keep from division happening and a bunch of confusion and everything, but it is confusing to me why it was like man-placing things rather than God-placing.
And I think there is something to say about, let's see, I wouldn't say man-pleasing as much as man-convincing. Like if you're convinced of an error of mine, that I'm doing something, living in a way that's wrong, is it man-pleasing for me to try to demonstrate I'm not? I want you to know that, because that could cause a breach in our relationship within the church. It's an entrance point for Satan to get in. Right? So I don't necessarily see it as man-pleasing, but I do see it as vindicating, man, you know, vindicating myself before men, which should not be our primary focus, but I do think it's appropriate to be a secondary focus. I don't want to do anything that will cause a stumbling block in front of you. And if I do, I think it's in 1 Corinthians where it says, suffer yourself to be defrauded. And in the context of that, it's talking about two people suing each other in the church. And it's saying, it'd be better, instead of going to a court of law, for you, first of all, to come to the church, let the church hear it and decide. That's the first thing. But second thing, suffer yourself to be defrauded. Take the loss so there's not a breach in fellowship between these two church members. And so that's how I read it, is not man-pleasing, but definitely man-vindicating, right? Which in the right context, I could see being okay, right? Somebody else have a thought? Right, so then the elders transition to the Gentiles. So they're talking about Paul's relationship with the Jewish believers in Jerusalem. We want to make sure that you're gaining an audience, that you gain respect, that that relationship is good. But as it relates to the Gentiles, verse 25, which believe, we have written and concluded that they observe no such thing. Now, I think that written is referencing the letter in Acts 15. Okay? And the reason I think that is because of the next section. Save only that they keep themselves from things offered to idols and from blood and from strangled and from fornication. If you remember, that's exactly what was written in Acts 15, verses 23 through 30. Those were the exact things that were written. So it seems like they're saying, we've already taken care of the Gentile thing in the minds of the people when we wrote that letter in Acts 15. Which, by the way, at this point was years ago. That had been 4 or 5 years at least to this point. Likely a lot longer than 4 or 5 years. But they're saying, I don't think that Gentile thing is going to be a problem because of those letters. Then Paul took them in. So Paul doesn't object. It just says, then Paul took the men, and the next day, purifying himself with them, entered into the temple to signify the accomplishment of the days of purification until an offering should be offered for every one of them. I just don't even want to comment on that because I don't understand all that. Right? So he's carrying out this purification act through a blood sacrifice. Right? Now, again, I know we've talked about this before. I know there are Jews today that will celebrate, Christian Jews today that will celebrate ancient Jewish holidays. But there are Christians. I just don't know what I think about that. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I don't know. I think some of it could be wrong with it, right? If they're celebrating the Passover feast, I kind of have a problem with that, I think. Right, because
celebrate Easter as well.
I would think so. Yeah.
So, I mean, the Passover is just Easter. I mean, that's like the foretelling of Easter.
Mm-hmm.
Of what's coming there. So it seems like as long as they're doing both.
I have to think about it.
One is unnecessary.
Yes. Sure. Yes.
But it's almost like a cultural thing.
It is absolutely cultural.
Yeah.
Judaism, for people who are not even observant, is heritage and culture, and familial history and tradition, even when it's not really religion.
Mm-hmm.
And having been to a Passover,
but like a Passover, not a Christian Passover.
Jewish,
yeah.
That like Baruch Ha, yeah. The whole thing. I don't really see how you could do a traditional Jewish Passover feast and
So let me ask you this question. This is theoretical, obviously, and I would have to study how Christian Jews today would do it, because I know there's some that do. I used to listen to a radio program, and the radio host, I liked her a lot, but she was real weird about the Jews, if I'm being honest. She just had this obsession with the Jews, and she would interview Jewish rabbis who were Christians. And again, I don't understand how that works, but she would. And they would talk about celebrating Purim and all these different things. So if you're celebrating the Passover as a cultural remembrance and you're hearkening back to what Moses said, the deliverance out of Egypt, the firstborn, those are your things. And then I lay on top of that, in the middle of my Passover feast, Christ. Christ came and delivered, I think in Hebrews chapter 10 or 11, it says, or maybe 12, it says, it's chapter 12, the church of the firstborn. That seems to me to mean the firstborn ones, like referencing back to that we're all the church of the firstborn. We've all been saved by the Passover. That's just speculation and totally off topic. So if you're celebrating that and you're Christ-centered and you're remembering the heritage, but you're also, does anybody see a problem with that?
I would say, does it matter?
Does it matter in the sense of that they're doing it, or that what they're doing, does that matter?
What they're doing, does it matter?
Does it have a value to God and to them?
Right. I mean, again, it's tradition. Mm-hmm. It's just wrote out tradition. This is what we've done. Because I've been to Passover with the person that, the family that quasi goes to the temple every once in a while. And they just did it, and they had the old Maxwell booklet to explain, you know, to tell everybody what to do and what to say. So it's this Seder book. So, to me, it's just they're doing it just because they've always done it. Just like when, you know, sometimes we have traditions that we do, like two songs.
Sure.
You, then two songs. Is that right? No. Is it wrong? No. It's just how the church has evolved and what we do. No more, and we do have some people that request songs. But, you know, it's something that they've always done. They just get into it. Repeating themselves year after year.
So could we say with that, like that's a, and this is again a question, is this a comparable Christian custom that is not wrong but not commanded, would be foot washing? Like, I think we can discern from the scriptures it's not commanded, because in John 13, you say he's telling us to do that. He's talking about serving each other. Right? And so it's not an ordinance. He didn't establish it like the Lord's Supper or baptism, where it's an explicit ordinance. We know we walk away. Obviously, there are some churches that celebrate it as an ordinance, the foot washing. There are just some churches that say, no, it's not an ordinance. We don't have to do it, but we do it. And I could see value in it. This is me speaking. I could see value in the humility that it could cultivate in its participants. I'm not advocating it, but I could see the value of it. Just like I think, and I have the right to change my opinion in 10 minutes, okay? I could see the Passover for a Jew that's a heritage thing perhaps having value if Christ is at the center of it. Is he the center of it? Probably not, usually. Could that be dangerous in making people think that you now have to do all those things, that's a necessary part to really serve? Probably, that could be dangerous. I don't know, something for us to think about and kind of chew on in regards to what's just something to think about here. Because
it seems to me the danger would be if you are... A Christian and celebrating Passover, if not modifying it. If you do it traditionally as the Jews do, then what you're doing is you're saying, here's the Passover lamb that is yet to come.
Yes.
Well, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I would think that would be a problem. So you're...
Agreed.
You make it something it's not
mm-hmm.
at that time. You know, it's kind of trying to believe both things.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that part of that Passover would be, this is the Passover lamb who we now have with us. You know, that sort of thing.
And would it be safe to say in that example that the Lord's Supper effectively does what you're saying? I mean, that's why we literally ingest the bread and the wine. Is for the same concept behind the Passover, right? I don't know, something to think about and look over here. Let's finish this last section. It shouldn't take us just a minute. And when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews which were of Asia... So what city are these people from? We can know this for a fact. These are the people that beat up Paul. They're in Asia. Who are they? Anybody? Paul was just there the last chapter. The Ephesians, right? We're going to know where these people are from in just a moment. But we can know that because that's where they persecuted him. When they saw him in the temple, stirred up all the people and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man that teacheth all men everywhere against the people and the law in this place, and further brought Greeks also into the temple, and hath polluted this holy place. For they had seen before with him in the city of Trophimus an Ephesian, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple." So we talked about that guy last week. And the way I read this is Trophimus had been with Paul somewhere, and then they saw Trophimus in the temple, and they just assumed that Paul brought Trophimus to the temple. But you can come to your conclusion on that in verse 30. "And all the city was moved, and the people ran together. And they took Paul and drew him out of the temple, and forthwith the doors were shut. And as they went about to kill him..." So this just shows you the intensity of what's going on here. Notice the strong language. "And all the city was moved." This is not just 10 or 15 people. These people are saying, there's somebody that cries out, "Men of Israel." So this has likely been discussion all throughout Jerusalem for a long time about this problem, this troublemaker that's going all throughout the Gentile world, convincing Jews of all these terrible things. I think all that safe inference is made in this text. And they say, "Here he is. We found him. This is the guy that's causing all these troubles." And so they come together. They shut the door of the temple. They kick him out, and they're going to go kill him. And that's the explicit purpose of what they're doing, which had been prophesied multiple times already. That was their intent. So it seems like our brothers in Ephesus, our brothers and sisters in Tyre, they were all accurate in their assumption. I don't think that was just because the Holy Spirit had showed them that. I think they knew how much Paul was hated. And they knew, if he goes there, he's a dead man because he's the talk of the town. People are wanting to kill him. "And as they were about to kill him, tidings came unto the chief captain of the band that all Jerusalem was in an uproar." So it goes to the Gentiles, the soldiers, the Romans, "and who immediately took soldiers and centurions and ran down unto them. And when they saw the chief captain and the soldiers, they left beating of Paul." So this is a pretty common thing that would happen in a riot. You get somebody in the middle of a group of people, and everybody's kicking on him and punching on him. And then somebody says, "The cops are here." Everybody runs. The guy stays right there laying down. That's what's occurring here, right? So they holler out. They say what's going on. So they leave beating him. "The chief captain comes near, takes him, and commanded him to be bound with two chains, and demanded who he was and what he had done." It's kind of a good question, probably one that a police officer would ask. "And some cried one thing, some another among the multitude. And when he could not know the certainty for the tumult, he commanded him to be carried into the castle." And that word castle just means the barracks, right? I was kind of curious whether Jesus was taken to the same barracks. I'm not saying he was. From what I could tell, we could not find anywhere that's the case. They're in the same city Jesus was arrested, same city that Jesus was taken by the centurions. First goes to the house of Annas and Caiaphas, and then he's taken by the soldiers to the civil authorities, where Pilate he then meets and so forth. So makes you wonder if he was taken to the same place. Verse 35, and when he came upon the stairs, so it was that he was bore of the soldiers for the violence of the people. So verse 35 tells us how bad the beating was. So it seems like he's getting helped along. He gets to the stairs. He can't walk up the stairs because he's been beaten so badly. So these soldiers have to literally pick him up and carry him up the stairs. Now here's why that's important within our context. Paul gets up the stairs. Let's keep going. For the multitude of the people followed after, crying, "Away with him." So these people didn't just beat him. They wanted the same thing that happened to Jesus to happen to Paul. We're not dropping this. And as they've learned, sometimes they could bully the civil authorities into doing what they wanted. Because notice this context is the exact same. They come upon him. They say, "What has he done? Who is he?" Sound familiar? Same thing with Jesus, right? One tells one story, one tells the other. The same thing with the witnesses did with Jesus, right? They're standing before Caiaphas and Annas. They're giving contradictory stories. The same thing's happening to the Apostle Paul here. People are just throwing out things. They can't discern exactly what happened. But we're going to learn in a moment, these men start having an assumption about who he is. Here in just a minute. So Paul is so badly beaten, he's taken up these stairs, carried up there, and the people are following the soldiers. "Kill him! Away with him! We want him dead!" Right? Verse 37. And as Paul was to be led into the castle, he said unto the chief captain, "May I speak unto thee?" Who said, "Canst thou speak Greek? Art not thou the Egyptian which before these days made us an uproar and led us out into the wilderness, 4,000 men that were murderers?" So, here's how I read this, and again, this is me reading into it, so please take that as such. There is such a huge uproar, so much problem caused, that this man is assuming Paul is an awful man. A man who had been an Egyptian, we don't know who he was, but who had been an Egyptian just recently in Jerusalem that had led 4,000 men on a revolt. Now, you know, we know of Roman history that whenever a revolt would happen, the Roman guard had no mercy. So much that, I don't know if you've heard the historical story, I can't remember which one it is, maybe it was Spartacus, I can't remember if that was it or not, but where because of the slave uprising, they crucified people for like 30 miles.
Yes.
Yeah. And it was, so I mean, just think, every 2, 3, 5 feet for 30 miles along the main thoroughfare, people are crucified. And the Roman government did that to scare people. Don't ever start a revolt. So these Jewish people are sensitive to revolts. Don't matter if you're guilty or not, you're getting crucified to prove a point. Don't have an uprising. So the people are so stirred up that this man just assumes he has to be a huge troublemaker. He must be that Egyptian. So when Paul starts speaking Greek to him, he's shocked. He thought he was the Egyptian that led 4,000 men on a revolt out in the wilderness. Right? So again, to me, the detail that Luke gives here is meant to illustrate how much that there was an uproar. Right? Verse 39, but Paul said, "I am a man which am a Jew of Tarsus, a city in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city." So mean meaning insignificant. "And I beseech thee, suffer me to speak unto the people." And when he had given him license, Paul stood on the stairs and beckoned with the hand unto the people. And when there was a great silence, he spake unto them in the Hebrew tongue, saying, and that's where our chapter ends. Now, the only thing I'm going to say, and I'll be done, is that Paul is beaten so badly that he has to be carried up the stairs. Their intent when they were beating on him was to kill the guy. So you know they're going after the head, they're going after deadly organs, they're trying to kill him. Almost succeed, they bring him up these steps, and what was Paul thinking about? Their souls. awesome. I mean, it's just awesome. And I kind of love that the chapter ends right there. And then it's going to be what he says in the next chapter, is that he wants these people to be saved. And so he has no regard for his own physical welfare. And what an example to us. Likely not one of us, and if so, it would be probably one of us, would ever be persecuted in this fashion, right? Because we live in such peace today, right? That if we had one of us that happened to, it would be an extraordinary thing. And yet, so often what causes us to be disheveled and thrown off caring about people's souls are such trivial light matters. Here he's beaten half dead. He's now chained with two chains. And as he's being carried up the stairs by the soldier, he says, "Can I please speak to these people?" Not, "Hey, my friend down there is Luke. He's a physician. Can he come to me?" It's not what he asked for. "Can I preach to these people?" I say that because I think what Paul would want us to do is not sit here and say, "Oh, what a man Paul is." I think it's to cause us to realize that's the significance of the gospel being preached to people who need it. That we would disregard self to the extent that maybe our injuries are going to lead to death, but with my dying breath, even the people who have caused this to me, I want them to know the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And to me, it's just a powerful ending to this chapter. Right? All the setup, all the troubles, and it helps us to better understand. If I could encourage you to do something, if I can remember the chapter, it's right before Paul talks about having a thorn in the flesh. I think it'd be 2 Corinthians 11, maybe. Go and read 2 Corinthians 11. Let me make sure that's what it is. Yeah, it is. 2 Corinthians 11, where Paul begins to list all the suffering that he went through. And we've not got to all of them yet in the book of Acts, but we've gotten to a number of them. And to me, this one, there's a time where he says, starting in probably verse 16 would be a good place to start. But, you know, some people are boasting about their, you know, who they were. And he says in verse 23, "Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more, in labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequent, in death often." So we've seen that now a number of times, right? "Of the Jews, 5 times received I 40 stripes save one," so 39 stripes. "Thrice I was beaten with rods, once I was stoned." We know where that was too, the first trip, right? We learned about in Derby, he was stoned and left for dead. So that's what he's referencing right there. "Thrice I suffered shipwreck." We haven't got there yet on the most notable shipwreck he had. "A night and a day I have in the deep, in journeys often, in robbers, in perils of water, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils by the heathen, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness and painfulness, and watchings often, and hunger and thirst, and fastings often, and cold and nakedness." And then listen to this. "Besides those things that are without, that which cometh upon me daily, the care of all the churches." Okay, so he's going through all these physical things. And we've read over and over, the heathen, meaning the Gentiles, did all these things to him. The Jews did all these things to him. And I think in the NASB version, it says something like, "In beatings more often than I can count." So that moment, he can't remember how many times he'd been beaten. This is probably one of those. And amongst all of that, he's not just the pastor of one church. That's like a mature church been established for 230 years. These are brand new works that are just started. He has the care of all those places. He's writing letters to all of those places, encouraging all those people. And as we've gone through Acts and seen his persecution, yet all the while, I think this last section shows where his mind is at. "I just want the people to hear the gospel of Christ." and will sacrifice what is required. And to me, that's a good place to end tonight on the example that Paul is to us. Just a tremendous, tremendous, just powerful account here as we end tonight. Somebody have a thought, comment you want to make? Now, these next parts are going to be pretty easy to follow. We've had to kind of jump around. We had a map on every lesson for the last so many weeks just to kind of follow where we're going and try to connect all the dots. This is going to start being a lot easier because Paul's in prison now. He's chained up. And he's just basically going through the court system. He's trying to get to Rome, which would be, in our mind, the Supreme Court. That's where he's headed. And so he's going to appeal these things. But all along the way, he's just taking every court opportunity to share the gospel. Again, we've talked about it earlier in Acts. His goal is not freedom. Not his goal. Actually, for a while, it's quite the opposite. He doesn't want to be free. That's why he appeals to Caesar. So he can remain where he's at. Because in those places going through court, he's going to have platform to be able to share the gospel. So how, again, this is talking about a mature faith. He has lost sight of this world. He has lost sight of it. He does not care about his body. He does not care about his freedom. He does not care about where he's living. He doesn't care how much money he has. He doesn't care if he's working in cities to support himself or whether people are supporting him. He is free from all of those things. All he is doing is being a beacon for the gospel. That is it. And he is not meant to be unique in that. That's us. We are meant to be that. Where we lose sight of those things as much as we are able. And all we're mindful of. Lord, if it's prison you want me to go, just let me sing and praise you there. And look what happens in Acts 16. If I can get to the whole Praetorium Guard, we learned in Philippians chapter 1, and all the Romans, centurions, hear about the gospel, great. And if people outside of prison who are brothers in Christ begin to preach out of envy and strife, but the gospel is being heard, I'm okay with that too. All Paul is mindful is the gospel is getting out. And it seems to me, the closer he marches towards his death, the more he is that way. The more he's just, I don't care about the money. And I would ask this question, how much money do you think the Paul the Apostle left behind for people as an inheritance? Probably not a lot. Right, what kind of a business empire did he build? Probably didn't leave one. He just lost sight of it all. He wasn't much of an athlete at the end of his day. His body was probably old, wounded. He probably had Luke around quite a bit. Right? I need help. He probably had to get help from room to room. Right, barely able to walk because of the beatings he had taken. But it was the gospel that he was after. And it's just such a powerful, his life is such a powerful example to us of somebody who God graced with the ability to focus solely upon the spiritual things that matter. And his life is testifying to us of that in the book of Acts. And I'm so thankful the Lord saw fit to leave it behind, because what a powerful example it is to us. And so I would say this to even any of you who are laboring, keep going. Keep laboring to do the right thing, to serve the Lord. Keep laboring. Keep laboring. And let Paul be our example in doing that. As he says to the churches in Galatia that he knew very well, traveled there 4 times. Don't be weary in well-doing. In due season, you'll reap if you faint not. And every line of that sentence he could speak to. Because he saw it. And so, anybody else tonight? I'm done.